Well, thank you very much, and it's very exciting for me to be able to follow that wonderful presentation with mine, because I think that a lot of the types of questions that that Amanda and her collaborators are trying to answer are the same types of questions we're trying to answer, but we're trying to do it in a very different way, or a different methodological way. So I think it'll be very nice for you to be able to see two very different approaches for trying to get at that same exact question. I really probably don't need to go over this for the people in the room, but just very, very basic overview. Parent-mediated intervention is a common approach to teaching social communication skills to young children with ASD. And we've been doing parent-mediated or parent intervention or parent training for a long time. What I think is really unique is over the past, say, 10 to 15 years, we've seen a large increase in the number of interventions that are specifically developed for very young children with ASD that are focused on increasing social communication skills. And as Amanda mentioned, that there are a number of these interventions that are out there now that share a number of common strategies. I would consider this approach, along with a number of our colleagues, we've sort of talked about this being a naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention approach that combines elements from the developmental literature and developmental science with interventions, strategies coming from applied behavior analysis, and they're implemented in natural environments such as play and daily routines. So it's very exciting to see, especially being at IMFAR this time, because we've been seeing lots of talks showing evidence, increasing evidence of efficacy for these types of approaches. And I think that we are really starting to get to the point where we can say, yeah, there are a number of these strategies or a number of these programs that share a lot of common elements that seem to be really working for increasing social communication in young kids with ASD. And I'd say particularly what I'm going to be talking about is about language skills, but I think we can see it more broadly with the work that has been on JASPER, looking at joint engagement and other areas. However, that being said, I think Amanda did a great job of pointing out that although we are seeing that these types of interventions that share many strategies are showing similar types of gains in child skills, it's really not necessarily clear how our interventions are working. So we have an intervention, we give it to the parent, they give it to the child, and at the end we see improvements in child behaviors. And we'd like to conclude that what we're teaching the parents to do is an active component. But it hasn't been until recently that we've actually started to look at this question of what is it exactly that's being done in the intervention and what is changing that's actually leading to these outcomes. And I think this is really essential to understand the active ingredients of these interventions, particularly as we start to think about moving these interventions out into the community. As we saw at one of the pre-conferences through the Autism Toddler Treatment Network, when we start thinking about things like dissemination and implementation of our interventions, we need to think about where these interventions are going, and they're going to be used by community providers. And there's a big discussion or debate, I should say, in the field of implementation science that talks about the adaptation fidelity debate, which is basically this understanding that when interventions move from the lab setting into community settings, community providers start doing stuff to our interventions as much as we would like them not to. And so when we think about trying to understand what are the active ingredients in our intervention, this can really help provide guidance around what types of adaptations are likely to continue to maintain the effectiveness of our interventions and what types of adaptations are likely to decrease the effectiveness of our interventions. But at this point, many of us, or I would say for much of it, we don't really know. So it's really hard to say you can't change this, but you can change that if we don't really know what this and that are actually doing. And this is really true for pretty much any intervention. But when we think about what the active ingredients of parent-mediated interventions are, we have a little bit of an additional level of complexity, which I will discuss in a moment. So when we think about thinking about the active ingredients of any type of intervention, we're really thinking about what is it about the intervention that's actually producing the changes in outcomes. And for purposes of what we're talking about here, we're really talking about changes in child outcomes. And I think Connie Castry and I want to say 2002 paper did a really great job of talking about some potential active ingredients that we really need to be thinking about in our more comprehensive and complex interventions. that include things like the specific training approach that's being used with the child. What is the intervention philosophy and the actual intervention approach itself? And I would say, even in that, many of our interventions actually are multi-component or have multiple treatment techniques. So not only the intervention approach, but the specific techniques that are included in that approach. We also can think of different types of treatment targets. Our interventions are targeting different skills, and those different skills may be active ingredients in broader child gains, as well as setting effects. Where is the intervention being implemented? Does it matter if the intervention is being implemented in the home, in a center, in a school, in a one-to-one setting, or is the active ingredient the involvement of peers in a group setting? As well as hours of contact. So we know that intensity matters, but beyond that, we don't really know exactly how many hours are really important, and is it the hours of contact versus what's being done in those hours that matter. So this is important for all of our interventions. But when we're talking about parent-mediated interventions, we're adding a whole layer of complexity because our intervention provider is actually the parent, not an intervention provider. And that means we also have to think about what are the active ingredients of what we're doing to change the parent behavior. If we're thinking what the parent is doing matters, we have to think about how we're going to get the parents to do what we want them to do. So we could actually ask these same questions about what are the active ingredients of our parent training program and changing parent behavior. And I've always tried to keep an eye towards where are we going with our interventions. And so many of us have thought about we need to start developing ways we can get community providers to do this. And for those of you who've worked with community providers, many of them need specific training in parent-mediated interventions on how to do that. So we can actually even think about this even bigger picture of what are the active ingredients of how we're training our providers to train parents to train their children. And when you start to think about that, we can really think about this as being at every level. And if you're not already overwhelmed, I don't know what you are. I mean, when we think about trying to understand how a parent-mediated intervention that's designed for community providers to use works, I think I have the next, 30 years of my career headed out there for me. So what I want to talk about is if we're doing all of this within randomized controlled trials, this is really the gold standard. This is amazing. But it may take us a really long time to unpack these very large, complex interventions. So I'm interested in using some different methodologies to try and get at this as we're developing our interventions. And in this case, I think single-case experimental designs or single-subject designs can be a really nice additional tool for looking at this. And for those of you that don't have a background in this, I'm going to do like the one-minute overview. So single-subject designs are implemented with a small number of participants who are repeatedly assessed throughout time in a non-treatment or baseline control condition as well as treatment. And the repeated assessment allows the individuals behavior during non-treatment or during baseline to be compared to their behavior during treatment. So the actual comparison is not between individuals that have been in a treatment and a control group, but a comparison within the individual of the individual's response without treatment to the individual's response to treatment. A key aspect is multiple phases or conditions. So we have the baseline phase, typically, which starts our intervention, and then a treatment or one or more treatment conditions, and these are compared to each other. And another key aspect is the replication of these experimental effects. So the more replications we have, be that within the individual, like you would have in an ABAB design, which is depicted here, where you have a baseline phase, where you look at the behavior, then you have a treatment phase, and then you change back to baseline and see if the behavior follows that. Does the behavior revert to original baseline levels, followed by another treatment phase? Does it go back to the previous treatment response? The more replications that we have, the greater confidence we have in a functional relationship between our treatment and the behavior. This can also be done across participants in a single-case designs, multiple baselines designs, which is actually what I'm going to be talking about. Typically, these designs are analyzed using visual analysis, so looking at the data, which means we're looking for pretty big effects to be able to see it. But more recently, people have been interested in aggregating across single-subject designs to give us an idea of sort of how, across all the literature that's been done, how are our interventions working together. And so people have been interested in synthesizing these data using multi-level modeling. And primarily, this approach has been used to look for effect sizes across studies, as you would see in a meta-analysis. But I also think that this approach might be very useful for looking at moderators of treatment effects across studies, as well as what I'm going to be talking about very briefly today, but hit on today, looking for relationships between co-occurring behaviors that might be a little bit difficult to observe visually. When you have an individual in a room who's doing a lot of different things, it's hard to necessarily know which of those things are the actual ones that are changing behaviors when they're all happening together. So this might be a way that we can kind of tease this out a little bit, and I think parent-mediated interventions offer a really good opportunity to do this. So I'm going to talk about, very briefly, our intervention, which is, again, an NBDI approach, an DBI approach. And this is an intervention that we developed this a slightly different way from the way we've developed most interventions, where most interventions are developed in a lab and you understand how they work before you move them into the community. Well, we actually came at this from a slightly different approach, which is what we felt like there's a lot of good stuff out there to suggest parent-mediated intervention using standard, using a collection of naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention techniques should work. So what we're going to do is we're going to start in the community and make sure we develop a model that's actually adoptable and implementable by community providers. So this is an intervention that was developed in a community-based setting using best practices in early intervention, which is an NBDI approach targeting social communication, specifically targeting social engagement, language and communication, imitation, and play. And one of the aspects of this intervention that I think really makes it unique is that we really focused on elements that are necessary to support adoption and implementation by community providers, community programs. So the structure of how we put the techniques together, in what way the parents are trained, what the training materials look like, were all developed through an iterative process with parents and community providers in community programs. So we've done several feasibility studies of this approach, and we find that it's highly acceptable to parents and providers. And it seems to work well in community settings. And now what we want to do is we want to unpack that and bring it into the lab and really understand not just what, you know, when we give it to community providers and the kids get better, that's great. Really understanding what are the pieces of our model that are actually doing the heavy lifting. So the first question really is, does the intervention work? Sorry. So we're thinking here, our first thought was, let's make sure that the intervention we're teaching to the parents actually works as intended. And we have every reason to believe that it should, because we were drawing on evidence-based intervention strategies. But when you combine them in novel ways, it's possible that you lose some of their efficacy. So we really wanted to look at this first. But if you think about our big complex model, it doesn't make sense to do this within the full model where we've trained providers. So we started to do this by actually having an expert implement the intervention. So we could understand, under ideal conditions in the lab, does that intervention work? So we had this with expert therapists using multiple baseline design across 9 children, and the children were on between the ages of 2 and 6, all with a significant language delay ranging from nonverbal to simple phrase speech. Children attended the lab for 2 30-minute sessions twice a week. They had 2 to 6 weeks of baseline, followed by 8 weeks of treatment, and then there was a 1-month follow-up. And really, for this particular study, we were looking at expressive language as an outcome. And for us, expressive language was individually determined based on the child's language targets, which was basically one step above where they currently were. So this is how we would actually analyze our data using our visual analysis. This is single case design for one of our participants. And you can see here for use of expressive language targets during baseline, he wasn't doing it. This was a nonverbal child. His language target was verbal approximation. So he wasn't really making contingent sounds. So our goal for him was to get him to increase his verbal approximations. In our baseline condition, where we did free play with the child but did not institute the intervention strategies, we see no use of the intervention, no use of the language target. With treatment, we see a nice increase in his use of the word approximations, and we see maintenance at follow-up. And we did this when we actually analyzed our data. We actually analyzed our data like this, visually, for each kid. And I would say that we found very similar patterns across all 9 kids, ranging from nonverbal children to children that had simple phrase speech coming in. But when we analyze it, we stack our graphs, and it is impossible to do this without making your eyes cross in a PowerPoint presentation. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to present this in aggregate form. And here we actually also use multi-level modeling to ask this question, is when we're actually aggregating across children, within, and we had a large sample. As a large sample for a single subject design is 9. I mean, that is pretty large. Are we getting an effect of treatment phase on child language? And we find that we do. And this is very nice because the multi-level modeling data actually match very nicely to our interpretation of the visual analysis. So we saw improvements between baseline and treatment, and we saw maintenance at follow-up. So we feel like we have some evidence to suggest that this intervention, the intervention that we're going to teach the parents, actually works in the way we think it should for improving child language. So the next question then is, does the parent training model work? And here we were interested in looking at the way in which we are trying to teach parents to do this intervention. Is this indeed changing parent behavior in a meaningful way? So I'm not going to go into it now, but we have a very specific parent training protocol that involves a number of steps in terms of collaborative goal setting, modeling. There's parent practice and feedback and coaching, homework, and reflection. So there's lots of pieces to it. We wanted to know whether or not that intervention is actually changing behavior of parents. And another aspect that we really wanted to look at was whether hours of contact matter. And the reason we wanted to do this is when we developed our intervention, again, we did develop it in community settings to make sure that what we developed was something that would be implementable in a community setting. But what we came up with was a twice-a-week parent training program where parents attend twice a week. And even though we developed it in a community setting, we've had a number of community providers that have come back to us and say, you know, we only want to do it once a week because that's really what fits in our model. We really see families once a week. And so we've kind of done that. So here we have people, this example of this adaptation versus fidelity. They are going and changing our model. So we figured we better figure out whether or not the amount of time we're spending with the parents training them actually matters, because if it doesn't, awesome. If it does, we need to make sure that people understand that. So we also wanted to look at the difference between training once a week versus twice a week. So again, We used our expert trainers, which are our wonderful graduate students, to do this, to take out the middle piece so we could really understand how the training model is working. And we had a multiple baseline design across 8 mother-child dyads. We had 3 families that received training once per week for 60 minutes and 5 families that received the same training twice per week, the original model. Again, 2 to 6 weeks of baseline, the 12-week training program, and 1 month follow-up. And we were looking at parent fidelity and child expressive language. So here's, again, some single subject design for one of our families. And one of the things that I wanted to mention, and I also think this maps really nicely onto what Amanda was talking about, is we actually have what we consider fidelity dimensions, but she used a different term, which was the other thing she was saying, the component, treatment components, or anyway, we call them fidelity dimensions, same idea. We have sets of strategies that we actually have that are what we think are kind of our main aspects. We have them, we have 4 of them, and they actually are taught to parents over time. So parents are taught, first they're taught to make play interactive, which is to follow the child's lead, imitate the child, and use heightened animation. And you can see here we have the little arrow indicates when that actually, the training for that particular skill set occurred. And what we can see is a really nice improvement in the parents' use of that skill when we actually taught it. Modeling and expanding language is another set of strategies. And again, we see a little bit of movement before we taught it, but it starts to become much more stable when we start to teach it. Providing opportunities for initiations is a collection of strategies, including balance turns, playful obstruction, and communicative temptations. And again, we see improvements when we start to teach it. And helping increase the complexity of initiations are prompting strategies done within natural contexts. And again, improvements there. And so we found very, very similar patterns across our parents. So we really started to see we have good evidence to suggest that the way in which we're teaching is actually changing parent behavior as you would expect. When we look at overall fidelity, we found really nice effects of treatment phase, improvements from baseline to treatment, and maintenance at follow-up when we're looking across parents. And ultimately, we want to know if this is going to work for kids. So we actually looked at spontaneous use of expressive language targets. And we found also similar changes that you would expect, but we also saw, unlike our first study, greater improvements actually at follow-up, which is what you would expect to see for a parent-mediated intervention, where the parents are using the intervention at full dose over time. We peeked to see whether or not it mattered whether we trained the parents once a week or twice a week, and it actually didn't. Parents got the skill when we taught it to them. So I think we can safely say we can go ahead and modify it, at least in that way. And then finally, we have a lot of strategies. So one of the questions we had was, well, what of these sets of strategies are actually most closely associated with the use of child language? And we use multi-level modeling to do this, where the child's spontaneous language use was the outcome, and the four fidelity dimensions were the predictors. And what we actually found was two of our sets of strategies were significantly associated with child's spontaneous language, making play interactive and helping increase the complexity of child initiation, so prompting procedure. So when we take all of this together, we feel that we have preliminary support for key components of a parent-mediated intervention program that's feasible for use in community settings. In particular, two sets of our strategies were directly related to child spontaneous language. And I think this is really helpful for us to understand sort of how it's working. And it may make us think a little bit more about all the techniques. Do we need to use all of them? Do we not need to use all of them? But what we do know is we need to make sure we have high fidelity on at least those two dimensions to get child change. We also found that sessions can be modified to once a week. And then I think a greater take-home message is that we really should be doing this for all of these different aspects that I was talking about. I think these two single subject designs only look at two small elements of the approach. But I think a take-home is that we can also use single case designs to understand how our interventions are working in combination with RCTs. And this may be particularly appropriate for examining individual components of these very complex models where it may be prohibitive to conduct studies with really large samples before we really know how things are working. So thank you very much. I want to thank the families, and I want to thank my lab, my graduate students, and I want to thank Debbie Cashy, who is a statistician who was very helpful in working me through the multi-level modeling. So thank you. And we have time probably for maybe two questions or a few questions. Yes.
So I want to ask about the prompting.
Yes.
So when we talk about different kinds of interventions, there's a different definition for prompting, whether it's scaffolding or physical prompting, or can you talk a little bit more about that? Like one of the key differences between developmental and developmental behavioral interventions. So how did you find that prompting?
Oh, we like the prompting. I would say that the prompting strategies, for those of you who are familiar with it, share very similar strategies with PRT. So it's actually direct elicitation. For the prompting to be considered prompting, there needs to be withholding of a material, a direct cue for how the child should respond, and then reinforcement of the child's response with access to the materials. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. I think that would be something that would be better to be addressed in an RCT. I suppose you could also do it as a moderator analysis within an aggregate multi-level model across multiple single subject design studies. But I think predictors of response like that will probably require larger samples. It really, to be able to do this with single case design, I think it has to be behaviors that you can measure within the session that would be changeable within the session. Mm-hmm. I have one more question, if anyone has one. Yes?
Do you think it's cool that you found that prompting was important and that Amanda found that environmental arrangement was important and that you found that making play interactive is important and Amanda found that orientation is important?
I do. In fact, I did not know what those data were going to look like until I sat there, and I got very excited as I was watching them. And I think they're a little. I think we found slight differences, but we're also looking at different outcomes. And I really take what Amanda said to be the case that we can look at this with different outcomes. And I actually think that some of these strategies might differ depending on what our child outcomes are. So we were looking at expressive language here, but I would imagine maybe if we were looking at something like receptive language, we might see modeling and expanding language doing more work. So I actually think that it's important to know not just what's working, but what's working for what behavior. So thank you.